In any case, thee slept at the Rocking Bee with Vaughn Eisenhart and our daughter Margaret, and she threw the dish for ye. I didn't speak of these things when we talked last night, for I knew them as well as you did. Anyro, we had other matters to discuss, did we not? Caves and such.
We did.
Roland tried not to show his surprise. He must have failed, because Henchik nodded slightly, the lips just visible within his beard curving in a slight smile.
The Mani have ways of knowing, gunslinger. Always have.
Will you not call me Roland?
Nay.
She said to tell thee that Margaret of the Redpath clan does fine with her heathen man, fine still.
Henchik nodded. If he felt pain at this, it didn't show, not even in his eyes.
She's damned, he said.
His tone was that of a man saying, looks like it might come off sunny by afternoon.
Are you asking me to tell her that?
Roland asked. He was amused and aghast at the same time. Henchik's blue eyes had faded and grown watery with age, but there was no mistaking the surprise that came into them at this question. His bushy eyebrows went up.
Why would I bother? He asked. She knows. She'll have time to repent her heathen man at leisure in the depths of Nar. She knows that, too. Come, gunslinger. Another quarter wheel and we're there. But it's Upsy.
8. Upsy it was. Very Upsy, indeed. Half an hour later they came to a place where a fallen boulder blocked most of the path. Henchik eased his way around it, dark pants rippling in the wind, beard blowing out sideways, long-nailed fingers clutching for purchase. Roland followed. The boulder was warm from the sun, but the wind was now so cold he was shivering. He sensed the heels of his worn boots sticking out over a blue drop of perhaps 2,000 feet. If the old man decided to push him, all would end in a hurry, and in decidedly undramatic fashion. But it wouldn't, he thought. Eddie would carry on in my place, and the other two would follow until they fell. On the far side of the boulder, the path ended in a ragged, dark hole 9 feet high and 5 wide. A draft blew out of it into Roland's face. Unlike the breeze that had played with them as they climbed the path, this air was smelly and unpleasant. Coming with it, carried upon it, were cries Roland couldn't make out, but they were the cries of human voices. "Is it the cries of folks in Nar we're hearing?" he asked Henchik. No smile touched the old man's mostly hidden lips now.
"Speak not in jest," he said. "Not here, for you are in the presence of the infinite."
Roland could believe it. He moved forward cautiously, boots gritting on the rubbly scree, his hand dropping to the butt of his gun. He always wore the left one now, when he wore any, below the hand that was whole. The stench breathing from the cave's open mouth grew stronger yet, noxious if not outright toxic. Roland held his bandana against his mouth and nose with his diminished right hand. Something inside the cave. There in the shadows. Bones, yes, the bones of lizards and other small animals, but something else as well. A shape he knew.
"Be careful, gunslinger," Henchik said, but stood aside to let Roland enter the cave if he so desired.
"My desires don't matter," Roland thought. "This is just something I have to do. Probably that makes it simpler."
The shape in the shadows grew clearer. He wasn't surprised to see it was a door, exactly like those he'd come to on the beach. Why else would this have been called Doorway Cave? It was made of ironwood, or perhaps ghostwood, and stood about 20 feet inside the entrance to the cave. It was 6.5 feet high, as the doors on the beach had been. And like those, it stood freely in the shadows with hinges that seemed fastened to nothing. Yet it would turn on those hinges easily, he thought. Will turn, when the time comes. There was no keyhole. The knob appeared to be crystal. Etched upon it was a rose.
On the beach of the Western Sea, the three doors had been marked with the high speech, the prisoner on one, the lady of the shadows on another, the pusher on the third. Here were the hieroglyphs he had seen on the box hidden in Callahan's church. Unfound.
It means unfound, Roland said. Henchik nodded, but when Roland moved to walk around the door, the old man took a step forward and held out a hand.
Be careful, or he may be able to discover who those voices belong to for yourself.
Roland saw what he meant. 8 or 9 feet beyond the door, the floor of the cave sloped down at an angle of 50 or even 60 degrees. There was nothing to hold on to, and the rock looked smooth as glass. 30 feet down, this slippery slide disappeared into a chasm. Moaning, intertwined voices rose from it. And then, one came clear. It was that of Gabrielle Deschaine.
Roland, don't! His dead mother shrieked up from the darkness. Don't shoot, it's me, it's your...
But before she could finish, the overlapping crash of pistol shots silenced her. Pain shot up into Roland's head. He was pressing the bandana against his face almost hard enough to break his own nose. He tried to ease the muscles in his arm, and at first was unable to do so. Next, from that reeking darkness, came the voice of his father.
I've known since you toddled that you were no genius, Stephen Deschaine said in a tired voice. But I never believed until yestereve that you were an idiot. To let him drive you like a cow in a chute. Gods.
Never mind. These are not even ghosts. I think they're only echoes, somehow taken from deep inside my own head and projected. When he stepped around the door, minding the drop now to his right, the door was gone. There was only the silhouette of Henchik, a severe man-shape cut from black paper standing in the cave's mouth. The door is still there, but you can only see it from one side. And in that way, it's like the other doors, too.
A trifle upsetting, isn't it? Tittered the voice of Walter from deep in the doorway cave's gullet. Give it over, Roland. Better to give it over and die than to discover the room at the top of the dark tower is empty.
Then came the urgent blare of Eld's horn, raising gooseflesh on Roland's arms and hackles on the back of his neck. Cuthbert Allgood's final battle cry as he ran down Jericho Hill toward his death at the hands of the barbarians with the blue faces. Roland lowered the bandana from his own face and began walking again. One pace, two, three. Bones crunched beneath his boot heels. At the third pace, the door reappeared, at first side to, with its latch seeming to bite into thin air like the hinges on its other side. He stopped for a moment, gazing at this thickness, relishing the strangeness of the door just as he had relished the strangeness of the ones he'd encountered on the beach. And on the beach he had been sick almost to the point of death. If he moved his head forward slightly, the door disappeared. If he pulled it back again, it was there. The door never wavered, never shimmered. It was always a case of either or, there, not there. He stepped all the way back, put his splayed palms on the ironwood, leaned on them. He could feel a faint but perceptible vibration, like the feel of powerful machinery. From the dark gullet of the cave, Rhea of the Coos screamed up at him, calling him a brat who'd never seen his true father's face. Telling him his bitter tale burst her throat with her screams as she burned. Roland ignored it and grasped the crystal doorknob.
Nay, gunslinger, ye dare not, Henchik cried in alarm.
I dare, Roland said, and he did, but the knob wouldn't turn in either direction. He stepped back from it. But the door was open when you found the priest? He asked Henchik. They had spoken of this the previous night, but Roland wanted to hear more.
Aye, 'twas I and Jemin who found him. He knows we elder Mani seek the other worlds. Not for treasure, but for enlightenment.
Roland nodded. He also knew that some had come back from their travels insane. Others never came back at all.
These hills are magnetic and riddled with many ways into many worlds. We'd gone out to a cave near the old garnet mines, and there we found a message.
What kind of message?
'Twas a machine set in the cave's mouth, Henchik said. Push a button, and a voice came out of it. The voice told us to come here.
You knew of this cave before?
Aye, but before the pair came, it were called the Cave of Voices. For which reason thee now knows.
Roland nodded and motioned for Henchik to go on.
The voice from the machine spoke in accents like those of your comates, gunslinger. It said that we should come here, Jemin and I, and we'd find a door and a man and a wonder. So we did.
Someone left you instructions, Roland mused. It was Walter he was thinking of. The man in black, who had also left them the cookies that he called Keebler's. Walter was Flag, and Flag was Martin, and Martin, was he Merlin, the old rogue wizard of legend? On that subject, Roland remained unsure. And spoke to you by name?
Nay, he did not know as much, only called us the many folk.
How did this someone know where to leave the voice machine, do you think?
Henchik's lips thinned. Why must thee think it was a person? Why not a god speaking in a man's voice? Why not some agent of the over?
Roland said, gods leave sigils. Men leave machines.
He paused. In my own experience, of course, Pa.
Henchik made a curt gesture as if to tell Roland to spare him the flattery. Was it general knowledge that thee and thy friend were exploring the cave where you found the speaking machine?
Henchik shrugged rather sullenly. People see us, I suppose. Some, mayhap, watch over the miles with their spyglasses and binoculars. Also, there's the mechanical man. He sees much and prattles everlastingly to all who will listen.
Roland took this for a yes. He thought someone had known Per Callahan was coming, and that he would need help when he arrived on the outskirts of the Kala. How far open was the door? Roland asked.
These are questions for Callahan, Henchik said. I promise to show thee this place. I have. Surely that's enough for you.
Was he conscious when you found him?
There was a reluctant pause, then, nay, only muttering, as one does in his sleep if he dreams badly.
Then he can't tell me, can he? Not this part. Henchik, you seek aid and succor. This thee told me on behalf of all your clans. Help me, then. Help me to help you.
I do not see how this helps.
And it might not help. Not in the matter of the wolves, which so concerned this old man and the rest of Calabrin Sturgis, but Roland had other worries and other needs, other fish to fry, as Susanna sometimes said.
He stood looking at Henchik, one hand still on the crystal doorknob. It were open a bit, Henchik said finally. So were the box. Both just a bit. The one they call the old fella, he lay face down, there.
He pointed to the rubble and bone-littered floor where Roland's boots were now planted.
The box were by his right hand, open about this much.
Henchik held his thumb and forefinger, perhaps 2 inches apart.
Coming from it was the sound of the common. I've heard him before, but never so strong. They made my very eyes ache and gush water. Jemin cried out and began walking toward the door. The old fellow's hands were spread out on the ground, and Jemin treaded on one of them and never noticed. The door were only ajar like the box, but a terrible light was coming through it. I've traveled much, gunslinger, to many wares and many winds. I've seen other doors, and I've seen Todashtakan, the holes in reality, but never any light like that. It were black, like all the emptiness that ever was. But there was something red in it.
The eye, Roland said.
Henchik looked at him. An eye? Do you say so?
I think so, Roland said. The blackness you saw is cast by Black 13. The red might have been the eye of the Crimson King.
Who is he?
I don't know, Roland said.
only that he bides far east of here, in Thunderclap or beyond it. I believe he may be a guardian of the Dark Tower. He may even think he owns it.
At Roland's mention of the tower, the old man covered his eyes with both hands, a gesture of deep religious dread.
What happened next, Henchik? Tell me, I beg.
I began to reach for Jemin, then recalled how he stepped on the man's hand with his boot heel and thought better of it. Thought, Henchik, if thee does that, he'll drag you through with him.
The old man's eyes fastened on Roland's.
Traveling is what we do, I know you ken as much. And rarely are we afraid, for we trust the over. Yet I were afraid of that light and the sound of those chimes.
He paused.
Terrified of them. I've never spoken of that day.
Not even to Per Callahan?
Henchik shook his head.
Did he not speak to you when he woke up?
He asked if he were dead. I told him that if he were so, so were we all.
What about Jemin?
Died 2 years later.
Henchik tapped the front of his black shirt.
Heart.
How many years since you found Callahan here?
Henchik shook his head slowly back and forth in wide arcs, a manly gesture so common it might have been genetic.
Gunslinger, I know not, for time is...
Yes, in drift, Roland said impatiently. How long would you say?
More than 5 years, for he has his church and superstitious fools to fill it, you can.
What did you do? How did he save Jemin?
Fell on my knees and closed the box, Henchik said. 'Twas all I could think to do. If I'd hesitated even a single second, I do believe I would have been lost, for the same black light were coming out of it. It made me feel weak and dim.
I'll bet it did, Roland said grimly.
But I moved fast, and when the lid of the box clicked down, the door swung shut. Jemin banged his fists against it and screamed and begged to be let through. Then he fell down in a faint. I dragged him out of the cave. I dragged them both out. After a little while in the fresh air, both came to.
Henchik raised his hands, then lowered them again as if to say, there you are. Roland gave the doorknob a final try. It moved in neither direction. But with the ball. Let's go back, he said. I'd like to be at the pair's house by dinner time. That means a fast walk back down to the horses, and an even faster ride once we get there.
Henchik nodded. His bearded face was good at hiding expression, but Roland thought the old man was relieved to be going.
Roland was a little relieved himself. Who would enjoy listening to the accusing screams of one's dead mother and father rising out of the dark? Not to mention the cries of one's dead friends.
What happened to the speaking device?
Roland asked as they started back down.
Henchik shrugged.
Do you ken Baderies?
Batteries.
Roland nodded.
While they worked, the machine played the same message over and over, the one telling us that we should go to the Cave of Voices and find a man, a door, and a wonder. There was also a song. We played it once for the pair, and he wept. You must ask him about it, for that truly is his part of the tale.
Roland nodded again.
Then the Baderies died.
Henchik's shrug showed a certain contempt for machines, the gone world, or perhaps both.
We took them out. They were Duracell. Does thee ken Duracell, Gunslinger?
Roland shook his head.
We took them to Andy and asked if he could recharge them, mayhap. He took them into himself, but when they came out again, they were as useless as before. Andy said sorry, we said thank you.
Henchik rolled his shoulders in that same contemptuous shrug.
We opened the machine, another button did that. And the tongue came out, it were this long.
Henchik held his hands 4 or 5 inches apart.
2 holes in it, shiny brown stuff inside, like string. The pair called it a cassette tape.
Roland nodded. I want to thank you for taking me up to the cave, Henchik, and for telling me all thee knows.
I did what I had to, Henchik said. And you'll do as ye promise, won't ye?
Roland of Gilead nodded. Let God pick a winner.
Aye, so we do say. You speak as if you knew us once upon a season.
He paused.
eyeing Roland with a certain sour shrewdness. Or is it just making up to me that she does? For anyone who's ever read the good book can thee and thou till the crows fly home.
Does thee ask if I play the toady, up here where there's no one to hear us but them?
Roland nodded toward the babbling darkness. Thou knows better, I hope. For if thee doesn't, thee's a fool.
The old man considered, then put out his gnarled, long-fingered hand.
Do ye well, Roland. 'Tis a good name, and a fair.
Roland put out his right hand, and when the old man took it and squeezed it, he felt the first deep twinge of pain where he wanted to feel at least.
No, not yet. Where I'd feel at least is in the other one, the one that's still whole.
Mayhap this time the wolves'll kill us all, said Henchik.
Perhaps so.
Yet still, perhaps we're well met.
Perhaps we are, the gunslinger replied.
Chapter 9. The Priest's Tale Concluded. Unfound.
1. Beds are ready, Rosalita Munoz said when they got back. Eddie was so tired that he believed she'd said something else entirely. Time to weed the garden, perhaps, or there's 50 or 60 more people that'd like to meet you waiting up to the church. After all, who spoke of beds at 3 in the afternoon?
Huh? Susanna asked blearily. What say, hun? Didn't quite catch it.
Beds are ready, the pair's woman of work repeated. You two'll go where you slept night before last. Young so's to have the pair's bed. And the bumbler can go in with ye, Jake, if ye'd like. Pair said for me to tell you so. He'd be here to tell you himself, but it's his afternoon for sick rounds. He takes the communion to him. She said this last with unmistakable pride.
Beds, Eddie said. He couldn't quite get the sense of this. He looked around as if to confirm that it was still mid-afternoon, the sun still shining brightly.
Beds?
Pear saw ye at the store, Rosalita amplified, and thought ye'd want naps after talking to all those people.
Eddie understood at last. He supposed that at some point in his life he must have felt more grateful for a kindness, but he honestly couldn't remember when or what that kindness might have been. At first, those approaching them as they sat in the rockers on the porch of Took's had come slowly in hesitant little clusters. But when no one turned to stone or took a bullet in the head, when there was in fact animated conversation and actual laughter, more and more came. As the trickle became a flood, Eddie at last discovered what it was to be a public person. He was astounded by how difficult it was, how draining. They wanted simple answers to 1,000 difficult questions. Where the gunslingers came from and where they were going were only the first two. Some of their questions could be answered honestly, but more and more Eddie heard himself giving weaselly politicians' answers and heard his two friends doing the same. These weren't lies, exactly, but little propaganda capsules that sounded like answers. And everyone wanted a look straight in the face and a do-you-find that sounded straight from the heart. Even Oi came in for his share of the work. He was petted over and over again and made to speak until Jake got up, went into the store, and begged a bowl of water from Eben Took. That gentleman gave him a tin cup instead and told him he could fill it at the trough out front. Jake was surrounded by townsfolk who questioned him steadily, even as he did this simple chore. Oi lapped the cup dry, then faced his own gaggle of curious questioners while Jake went back to the trough to fill the cup again. All in all, they had been 5 of the longest hours Eddie had ever put in, and he thought he would never regard celebrity in quite the same way again. On the plus side, before finally leaving the porch and heading back to the old fellow's residence, Eddie reckoned they must have talked to everyone who lived in town and a good number of farmers, ranchers, cowpokes, and hired hands who lived beyond it. Word traveled fast. The outworlders were sitting on the porch of the general store, and if you wanted to talk to them, they would talk to you. And now, by God, this woman, this angel, was speaking of beds.
How long have we got? He asked Rosalita.
Pear should be back by 4, she said, but we won't eat until 6. and that's only if your Din gets back in time. Why don't I wake you at 5:30? That'll give you time to wash. Does it do you?
Yeah, Jake said, and gave her a smile. I didn't know just talking to folks could make you so tired and thirsty.
She nodded. There's a jug of cool water in the pantry.
I ought to help you get the meal ready, Susanna said, and then her mouth opened in a wide yawn.
Sari Adams is coming in to help, Rosalita said, and it's no but a cold meal in any case. Go on now, take your rest. You're all in, and it shows.
2. In the pantry, Jake drank long and deep, then poured water into a bowl for Oi and carried it into Pear Callahan's bedroom. He felt guilty about being in here and about having a Billy Bumbler in here with him, but the bed covers on Callahan's narrow bed had been turned down, the pillow had been plumped up, and both beckoned him. He put down the bowl, and Oi quietly began to lap water. Jake undressed down to his new underwear, then lay back and closed his eyes. Probably won't be able to actually sleep, he thought. I wasn't ever any good at taking naps, even back when Mrs. Shaw used to call me Bama. Less than a minute later, he was snoring lightly, with one arm slung over his eyes. Oi slept on the floor beside him, with his nose on one paw. 3. Eddie and Susanna sat side by side on the bed in the guest room. Eddie could still hardly believe this, not only a nap, but a nap in an actual bed. Luxury piled on luxury. He wanted nothing more than to lie down, take Suze in his arms, and sleep that way. But one matter needed to be addressed first. It had been nagging him all day, even during the heaviest of their impromptu politicking.
Suze, about Tien's grandpair. I don't want to hear it, she said at once.
He raised his eyebrows, surprised, although he supposed he'd known.
We could get into this, she said, but I'm tired. I want to go to sleep. Tell Roland what the old guy told you, and tell Jake if you want to, but don't tell me, not yet.
She sat next to him, her brown thigh touching his white one, her brown eyes looking steadily into his hazel ones.
Do you hear me?
Hear you very well.
Say thank you, Big Big.
He laughed, took her in his arms, kissed her. And shortly, they were also asleep with their arms around each other and their foreheads touching. A rectangle of light moved steadily up their bodies as the sun sank. It had moved back into the true west, at least for the time being. Roland saw this for himself as he rode slowly down the drive to the old fellow's rectory house with his aching legs kicked free of the stirrups. 4. Rosalita came out to greet him.
Hail, Roland. Long days and pleasant nights.
He nodded. May you have twice the number.
I ken you might ask some of us to throw the dish against the wolves when they come.
Who told you so?
Oh, some little bird whispered it in my ear.
Ah, and would you? If asked.
She showed her teeth in a grin. Nothing in this life would give me more pleasure. The teeth disappeared and the grin softened into a true smile, although perhaps the two of us together could discover some pleasure that comes close. Would you see my little cottage, Roland?
Aye, and would you rub me with that magic oil of yours again?
Is it rubbed you'd be?
Aye.
Rubbed hard or rubbed soft?
I've heard a little of both. Best eases an aching joint.
She considered this, then burst into laughter and took his hand. Come, while the sun shines, and this little corner of the world sleeps.
He came with her willingly, and went where she took him. She kept a secret spring surrounded by sweet moss, and there he was refreshed. 5. Callahan finally returned around 5:30, just as Eddie, Susanna, and Jake were turning out. At 6, Rosalita and Sari Adams served out a dinner of greens and cold chicken on the screened-in porch behind the rectory. Roland and his friends ate hungrily, the gunslinger taking not just seconds but thirds. Callahan, on the other hand, did little but move his food from place to place on his plate.
The tan on his face gave him a certain look of health, but didn't hide the dark circles under his eyes. When Sari, a cheery, jolly woman, fat but light on her feet, brought out a spice cake, Callahan only shook his head. When there was nothing left on the table but cups and the coffee pot, Roland brought out his tobacco and raised his eyebrows.
"Do you?" Callahan said, then raised his voice. "Rosie, bring this guy something to tap into."
"Big man, I could listen to you all day," Eddie said.
"So could I," Jake agreed.
Callahan smiled.
"I feel the same way about you boys, at least a little."
He poured himself half a cup of coffee. Rosalita brought Roland a pottery cup for his ashes. When she had gone, the old fellow said,
"I should have finished this story yesterday. I spent most of last night tossing and turning, thinking about how to tell the rest."
"Would it help if I told you I already know some of it?" Roland asked.
"Probably not. You went up to the doorway cave with Henchik, didn't you?"
"Yes."
"He said there was a song on the speaking machine that sent them up there to find you and that you wept when you heard it.
Was it the one you spoke of?"
"Someone saved my life tonight, yes. And I can't tell you how strange it was to be sitting in a manny cabin in Calabrin Sturgis looking toward the darkness of Thunderclap and listening to Elton John."
"Whoa, whoa," Susanna said. "You're way ahead of us, Pear. Last we knew you were in Sacramento, it was 1981, and you just found out your friend got cut up by these so-called Hitler brothers."
She looked sternly from Callahan to Jake and finally to Eddie.
"I have to say, gentlemen, that you don't seem to have made much progress in the matter of peaceful living since the days when I left America."
"Don't blame it on me," Jake said. "I was in school."
"And I was stoned," Eddie said. "All right, I'll take the blame," Callahan said. And they all laughed.
"Finish your story," Roland said. "Maybe you'll sleep better tonight."
"Maybe I will," Callahan said.
He thought for a minute, then said,
"What I remember about the hospital, what I guess everyone remembers, is the smell of the disinfectant and the sound of the machines, mostly the machines, the way they beep. The only other stuff that sounds like that is the equipment in airplane cockpits. I asked a pilot once, and he said the navigational gear makes that sound. I remember thinking that night that there must be a hell of a lot of navigating going on in hospital ICUs. Rowan Magruder wasn't married when I worked at home, but I guessed that must have changed because there was a woman sitting in the chair by his bed reading a paperback. Well-dressed, nice green suit, hose, low-heeled shoes. At least I felt okay about facing her. I'd cleaned up and combed up as well as I could, and I hadn't had a drink since Sacramento. But once we were actually face to face, I wasn't okay at all. She was sitting with her back to the door, you see. I knocked on the jamb, she turned toward me, and my so-called self-possession took a hike. I took a step back and crossed myself. First time since the night Rowan and I visited Lupe in that same joint. Can you guess why?"
"Of course," Susanna said, "because the pieces fit together. The pieces always fit together. We've seen it again and again and again. We just don't know what the picture is."
"Or can't grasp it," Eddie said.
Callahan nodded.
"It was like looking at Rowan, only with long blonde hair and breasts. His twin sister. And she laughed. She asked me if I thought I'd seen a ghost. I felt surreal, as if I'd slipped into another of those other worlds, like the real one, if there is such a thing, but not quite the same. I felt this mad urge to drag out my wallet and see who was on the bills. It wasn't just the resemblance, it was her laughing. Sitting there beside a man who had her face, assuming he had any face left at all under the bandages, and laughing. 'Welcome to room 19 of the Todash Hospital,' Eddie said. 'Beg pardon? I only meant I know the feeling, Don. We all do. Go on.' I introduced myself and asked if I could come in. And when I asked it, I was thinking back to Barlow, the vampire, thinking you have to invite them in the first time. After that, they can come and go as they please. She told me, of course, I could come in. She said she'd come from Chicago to be with him in what she called his closing hours. Then, in that same pleasant voice, she said, "I knew who you were right away. It's the scar on your hand." In his letters, Rowan said he was quite sure you were a religious man in your other life. He used to talk about people's other lives all the time, meaning before they started drinking or taking drugs or went insane or all three. This one was a carpenter in his other life. That one was a model in her other life. Was he right about you? All in that pleasant voice, like a woman making conversation at a cocktail party. And Rowan, lying there with his head covered in bandages, if he'd been wearing sunglasses, he would have looked like Claude Rains in The Invisible Man. I came in. I said I'd once been a religious man, yes, but that was all in the past. She put out her hand. I put out mine. Because, you see, I thought...
Six. He puts out his hand because he has made the assumption that she wants to shake with him. The pleasant voice has fooled him. He doesn't realize that what Rowena Magruder Rawlings is actually doing is raising her hand, not putting it out. At first, he doesn't even realize he's been slapped, and hard enough to make his left ear ring and his left eye water. He has a confused idea that the sudden warmth rising in his left cheek must be some sort of cockamamie allergy thing, perhaps a stress reaction. Then she is advancing on him with tears streaming down her weirdly Rowan-like face.
"Go on and look at him," she says, "because guess what? This is my brother's other life, the only one he has left. Get right up close and get a good look at it. They poked out his eyes. They took off one of his cheeks. You can see the teeth in there, peek-a-boo. The police showed me photographs. They didn't want to, but I made them. They poked a hole in his heart, but I guess the doctors plugged that. It's his liver that's killing him. They poked a hole in that, too, and it's dying." "Miss Magruder, it's Mrs. Rawlings," she tells him. "Not that it's anything to you, one way or the other. Go on, get a good look. See what you've done to him."
"I was in California. I saw it in the paper."
"Oh, I'm sure," she says. "I'm sure, but you're the only one I can get hold of, don't you see? The only one who was close to him. His other pal died of the queer's disease, and the rest aren't here. They're eating free food down at his flop house, I suppose. Or talking about what happened at their meetings. How it makes them feel. Well, Reverend Callahan, or is it Father? I saw you cross yourself. Let me tell you how this makes me feel. It makes me furious."
She is still speaking in the pleasant voice, but when he opens his mouth to speak again, she puts a finger across his lips, and there is so much force pressing back against his teeth in that single finger that he gives up. Let her talk, why not? It's been years since he's heard a confession, but some things are like riding a bicycle.
"He graduated from NYU cum laude," she says. "Did you know that? He took second in the Beloit Poetry Prize competition in 1949. Did you know that? As an undergraduate. He wrote a novel, a beautiful novel. And it's in my attic, gathering dust."
Callahan can feel soft, warm dew settling on his face. It is coming from her mouth.
"I asked him, no, begged him, to go on with his writing, and he laughed at me, said he was no good. 'Leave that to the Mailers and O'Haras and Irwin Shaws,' he said. 'People who can really do it. I'll wind up in some ivory tower office, puffing on a meerschaum pipe and looking like Mr. Chips.' And that would have been all right, too," she says. "But then he got involved in the Alcoholics Anonymous program, and from there it was an easy jump to running the flophouse and hanging with his friends. Friends like you." Callahan is amazed. He has never heard the word friends invested with such contempt. "But where are they now that he's down and going out?" Rowena Magruder Rawlings asks him. "Hmm? Where are all the people he cured? All the newspaper feature reporters who called him a genius? Where's Jane Pauley? She interviewed him on the Today Show, you know, twice. Where's that fucking Mother Teresa? He said in one of his letters they were calling her the little saint when she came to home. Well, he could use a saint now. My brother could use a saint right now. Some laying on of hands. So where the hell is she?" Tears rolling down her cheeks.
her bosom rising and falling. She is beautiful and terrible. Callahan thinks of a picture he saw once of Shiva, the Hindu destroyer god. Not enough arms, he thinks, and has to fight a crazy, suicidal urge to laugh. They're not here. There's just you and me, right? And him. He could have won a Nobel Prize for Literature. Or he could have taught 400 students a year for 30 years. Could have touched 12,000 minds with his. Instead, he's lying here in a hospital bed with his face cut off, and they'll have to take up a subscription from his fucking flophouse to pay for his last illness, if you call getting cut to pieces an illness, and his coffin, and his burial. She looks at him, face naked and smiling, her cheeks gleaming with moisture and runners of snot hanging from her nose. In his previous other life, Father Callahan, he was the street angel, but this is his final other life. Glamorous, isn't it? I'm going down the hall to the canteen for coffee and a Danish. I'll be there for 10 minutes or so. Plenty of time for you to have your little visit. Do me a favor and be gone when I get back. You and all the rest of his do-gooders make me sick. She leaves. Her sensible low heels go clicking away along the hall. It's not until they've faded completely and left him with the steady beeping of the machines that he realizes he's trembling all over. He doesn't think it's the onset of the DTs, but by God, that's what it feels like. When Rowan speaks from beneath his stiff veil of bandages, Callahan nearly screams. What his old friend says is pretty mushy, but Callahan has no trouble figuring it out.
She's given that little sermon at least 8 times today. And she never bothers to tell anyone that the year I took second in the Belloid, only 4 other people entered. I guess the war knocked a lot of the poetry out of folks. How you doing, Don?
The diction is bad, the voice driving it, little more than a rasp, but it's Rowan all right. Callahan goes to him and takes the hands that lie on the counterpane. They curl over his with surprising firmness.
As far as the novel goes, man, it was third-rate James Jones, and that's bad.
How you doing, Rowan? Callahan asks. Now he's crying himself. The goddamn room will be floating soon.
Oh, well, pretty sucky, says the man under the bandages. Then, thanks for coming.
Not a problem, Callahan says. What do you need from me, Rowan? What can I do?
You can stay away from home, Rowan says.
His voice is fading, but his hands still clasp Callahan's.
They didn't want me. It was you they were after. Do you understand me, Don? They were looking for you. They kept asking me where you were, and by the end, I would have told them if I'd known, believe me. But of course I didn't.
One of the machines is beeping faster, the beeps running toward a merge that will trip an alarm. Callahan has no way of knowing this, but knows it anyway, somehow. Rowan, did they have red eyes? Were they wearing, I don't know, long coats? Like trench coats? Did they come in big fancy cars?
Nothing like that,
Rowan whispers.
They were probably in their 30s, but dressed like teenagers. They looked like teenagers, too. These guys will look like teenagers for another 20 years if they live that long. And then one day, they'll just be old.
Callahan thinks, just a couple of punks. Is that what he's saying? It is. It almost certainly is, but that doesn't mean the Hitler brothers weren't hired by the low men for this particular job. It makes sense. Even the newspaper article, brief as it was, pointed out that Rowan Magruder wasn't much like the brothers' usual type of victim.
Stay away from home, Rowan whispers.
But before Callahan can promise, the alarm does indeed go off. For a moment, the hands holding his tighten, and Callahan feels a ghost of this man's old energy, that wild, fierce energy that somehow kept Holmes' doors open in spite of all the times the bank account went absolutely flatline. The energy that attracted men who could do all the things Rowan Magruder himself couldn't. Then the room begins filling up with nurses. There's a doctor with an arrogant face yelling for the patient's chart, and pretty soon Rowan's twin sister will be back, this time possibly breathing fire. Callahan decides it's time to blow this pop shop and the greater pop shop that is New York City. The low men are still interested in him, it seems. Very interested indeed. And if they have a base of operations, it's probably right here in Fun City, USA. Consequently, a return to the West Coast would probably be an excellent idea. He can't afford another plane ticket, but he has enough cash to ride the big gray dog. Won't be for the first time, either. Another trip west, why not? He can see himself with absolute clarity, the man in seat 29C, a fresh, unopened package of cigarettes in his shirt pocket, a fresh, unopened bottle of Early Times in a paper bag, the new John D. MacDonald novel, also fresh and unopened, lying on his lap. Maybe he'll be on the far side of the Hudson, and riding through Fort Lee, deep into Chapter 1, and nipping his second drink before they finally turn off all the machines in room 577, and his old friend goes out into the darkness and toward whatever waits for us there.
7. 577, Eddie said.
19, Jake said.
Beg pardon?
Callahan asked again.
5, 7, and 7, Susanna said. Add them, you get 19.
Does that mean something?
Put them all together, they spell mother, a word that means the world to me, Eddie said with a sentimental smile.
Susanna ignored him.
We don't know, she said. You didn't leave New York, did you? If you had, you'd have never gotten that. She pointed to the scar on his forehead.
Oh, I left, Callahan said. Just not quite as soon as I intended. My intention when I left the hospital really was to go back down to Port Authority and buy a ticket on the 40 bus.
What's that? Jake asked.
Hobo speak for the farthest you can go. If you buy a ticket to Fairbanks, Alaska, you're riding on the 40 bus.
Over here it'd be bus 19, Eddie said.
As I was walking, I got thinking about all the old times. Some of them were funny, like when a bunch of the guys at home put on a circus show. Some of them were scary, like one night just before dinner when one guy says to this other one, "Stop picking your nose, Jeffy, it's making me sick." And Jeffy goes, "Why don't you pick this, homeboy?" And he pulls out this giant spring blade knife, and before any of us can move or even figure out what's happening, Jeffy cuts the other guy's throat. Lupe's screaming, and I'm yelling, "Jesus, holy Jesus!" And the blood is spraying everywhere because he got the guy's carotid. Or maybe it was the jugular. And then Rowan comes running out of the bathroom holding his pants up with one hand and a roll of toilet paper in the other. And do you know what he did?
"Used the paper," Susanna said.
Callahan grinned. It made him a younger man.
"You're bugger," he did. Slapped the whole roll right against the place where the blood was spurting and yelled for Lupe to call 211, which got you an ambulance in those days. And I'm standing there watching that white toilet paper turn red, working its way in toward the cardboard core. Rowan said, "Just think of it as the world's biggest shaving cut." And we started laughing. We laughed until the tears came out of our eyes. I was running through a lot of old times, do you? The good, the bad, and the ugly. I remember, vaguely, stopping in at a Smiler's Market and getting a couple of cans of Bud in a paper sack. I drank one of them and kept on walking. I wasn't thinking about where I was going, not in my conscious mind, at least. But my feet must have had a mind of their own, because all at once I looked around and I was in front of this place where we used to go to supper sometimes if we were, as they say, in funds. It was on 2nd and 52nd.
"Choo-choo mamas," Jake said.
Callahan stared at him with real amazement, then looked at Roland.
"Gunslinger, you boys are starting to scare me a little."
Roland only twirled his fingers in his old gesture. "Keep going, partner."
"I decided to go in and get a hamburger for old time's sake," Callahan said. "And while I was eating the burger, I decided I didn't want to leave New York without at least looking into home through the front window. I could stand across the street like the times when I swung by there after Lupe died. Why not? I'd never been bothered there before, not by the vampires, not by the low men either."
He looked at them.
"I can't tell you if I really believed that, or if it was some kind of elaborate, suicidal mind game. I can recapture a lot of what I felt that night, what I said, and how I thought, but not that.
In any case, I never got to home. I paid up and I went walking down 2nd Avenue. Home was at 1st and 47th. But I didn't want to walk directly in front of it, so I decided to go down to 1st and 46th and cross over there.
Why not 48th? Eddie asked him quietly.
You could have turned down 48th. That would have been quicker. Saved you doubling back a block.
Callahan considered the question, then shook his head.
If there was a reason, I don't remember.
There was a reason, Susanna said. You wanted to walk past the vacant lot.
Why would I?
For the same reason people want to walk past a bakery when the donuts are coming out of the oven, Eddie said. Some things are just nice, that's all.
Callahan received this doubtfully, then shrugged.
If you say so.
I do, Si.
In any case, I was walking along, sipping my other beer. I was almost at 2nd and 46th when...
What was there? Jake asked eagerly. What was on that corner in 1981?
I don't...
Callahan began, and then he stopped.
A fence, he said. Quite a high one, 10, maybe 12 feet.
Not the one we climbed over, Eddie said to Roland. Not unless it grew 5 feet on its own.
There was a picture on it, Callahan said. I do remember that, some sort of street mural, but I couldn't see what it was because the streetlights on the corner were out. And all at once, it hit me that wasn't right. All at once, an alarm started going off in my head. Sounded a lot like the one that brought all the people into Rowan's room at the hospital, if you want to know the truth. All at once, I couldn't believe I was where I was. It was nuts. But at the same time, I'm thinking...
8. At the same time, he's thinking, it's all right, just a few lights out is all it is. If there were vampires, you'd see them, and if there were low men, you'd hear the chimes and smell rancid onions and hot metal. All the same, he decides to vacate this area, and immediately, chimes or no chimes, every nerve in his body is suddenly out on his skin, sparking and sizzling. He turns, and there are two men right behind him. There's a space of seconds when they're so surprised by his abrupt change of direction that he probably could have darted between them like an aging running back and gone sprinting back up 2nd Avenue. But he is surprised, too, and for a further space of seconds, the three of them only stand there, staring. There's a big Hitler brother and a little Hitler brother. The little one is no more than 5'2". He's wearing a loose chambray shirt over black slacks. On his head is a baseball cap turned around backwards. His eyes are as black as drops of tar, and his complexion is bad. Callahan immediately thinks of him as Lenny. The big one is maybe 6'6", wearing a Yankees sweatshirt, blue jeans, and sneakers. He's got a sandy mustache. He's wearing a fanny pack, only around in front, so it's actually a belly pack. Callahan names this one George. Callahan turns around, planning to flee down 2nd Avenue if he's got the light, or if it looks like he can beat the traffic. If that's impossible, he'll go down 46th to the UN Plaza Hotel and duck into their lobby. The big one, George, grabs him by the shirt and yanks him back by his collar. The collar rips, but unfortunately not enough to set him free.
No, you don't, Doc, the little one says. No, you don't.
Then bustles forward, quick as an insect, and before Callahan's clear on what's happening, Lenny has reached between his legs, seized his testicles, and squeezed them violently together. The pain is immediate and enormous, a swelling sickness like liquid lead.
Like that, nigger lover?
Lenny asks him in a tone that seems to convey genuine concern, that seems to say, we want this to mean as much to you as it does to us. Then he yanks Callahan's testicles forward, and the pain trebles. Enormous, rusty, saw teeth sink into Callahan's belly, and he thinks he'll rip them off. He's already turned them to jelly, and now he's going to rip them right off. There's nothing holding them on but a little loose skin, and he's going to... He begins to scream, and George clamps a hand over his mouth. Quit it, he snarls at his partner. We're on the fucking street, did you forget that? Even while the pain is eating him alive, Callahan is mulling the situation's queerly inverted quality. George is the Hitler brother in charge, not Lenny. George is the big Hitler brother. It's certainly not the way Steinbeck would have written it. Then from his right, a humming sound arises, At first he thinks it's the chimes, but the humming is sweet. It's strong as well. George and Lenny feel it, and they don't like it.
"What's that?" Lenny asks. "Did you hear something?"
"I don't know. Let's get him back to the place, and keep your hands off his balls. Later you can yank him all you want, but for now just help me."
One on either side of him, and all at once he's being propelled back up Second Avenue. The high board fence runs past on their right. That sweet, powerful humming sound is coming from behind it.
"If I could get over that fence, I'd be all right," Callahan thinks. "There's something in there, something powerful and good. They wouldn't dare go near it."
Perhaps this is so, but he doubts he could scramble over a board fence 10 feet high, even if his balls weren't blasting out enormous bursts of their own painful Morse code, even if he couldn't feel them swelling in his underwear. All at once his head lolls forward, and he vomits a hot load of half-digested food down the front of his shirt and pants. He can feel it soaking through to his skin, warm as piss. Two young couples, obviously together, are headed the other way. The young men are big. They could probably mop up the street with Lenny and perhaps even give George a run for his money if they ganged up on him. But right now, they're looking disgusted and clearly want nothing more than to get their dates out of Callahan's general vicinity as quickly as they possibly can.
"He just had a little too much to drink," George says, smiling sympathetically. "And then, whoopsie-daisy, happens to the best of us from time to time."
"They're the Hitler brothers," Callahan tries to scream. "These guys are the Hitler brothers. They killed my friend, and now they're going to kill me. Get the police."
But of course nothing comes out. In nightmares like this, it never does. And soon the couples are headed the other way. George and Lenny continue to move Callahan briskly along the block of Second Avenue between 46th and 47th. His feet are barely touching the concrete. His choo-choo mama Swiss burger is now steaming on his shirt. Oh, boy, he can even smell the mustard he put on it.
"Let me see his hand," George says as they near the next intersection, and when Lenny grabs Callahan's left hand, George says, "No, dipstick the other one."
Lenny holds out Callahan's right hand. Callahan couldn't stop him if he tried. His lower belly has been filled with hot, wet cement. His stomach, meanwhile, seems to be quivering at the back of his throat like a small, frightened animal. George looks at the scar on Callahan's right hand and nods.
"Yeah, it's him, all right. Never hurts to be sure. Come on, let's go, fodder. Double time. Hup, hup."
When they get to 47th, Callahan is swept off the main thoroughfare. Down the hill on the left is a pool of bright white light. Home. He can even see a few slope-shouldered silhouettes, men standing on the corner, talking program and smoking. "I might even know some of them," he thinks confusedly. "Hell, probably do." But they don't go that far. Less than a quarter of the way down the block, between Second Avenue and First, George drags Callahan into the doorway of a deserted storefront with a for sale or lease sign in both of its soaped-over windows. Lenny just kind of circles them like a yapping terrier around a couple of slow-moving cows.
"Gonna fuck you up, nigger lover," he's chanting. "We done 1,000 just like you, gonna do 1,000,000 before we're through. We can cut down any nigger, even when the nigger's bigger." That's from a song I'm writing. It's a song called "Kill All Nigger-Loving Fags." I'm gonna send it to Merle Haggard when I'm done. He's the best. He's the one told all those hippies to squat and shit in their hats. Fucking Merle's for America. I got a Mustang 380 and I got Hermann Goering's Luger. You know that, nigger lover? "Shut up, you little punk ass," George says, but he speaks with fond absent-mindedness, reserving his real attention for finding the key he wants on a fat ring of them and then opening the door of the empty storefront. Callahan thinks, to him, Lenny's like the radio that's always playing in an auto repair shop or the kitchen of a fast-food restaurant. He doesn't even hear him anymore. He's just part of the background noise.
"Yeah, Nort," Lenny says, and then goes right on. "Fucking Goering's fucking Luger, that's right. And I might blow your fucking balls off with it, because we know the truth about what nigger lovers like you are doing to this country, right, Nort?"
"Told you, no names,"
George Nort says, but he speaks indulgently, and Callahan knows why. He'll never be able to give any names to the police, not if things go the way these douchebags plan.
Sorry, Nort, but you nigger lovers, you fucking Jew boy intellectuals, are the ones fucking this country up, so I want you to think about that when I pull your fucking balls right off your fucking scrot.
The balls are the scrot, numwit, George Nort says in a weirdly scholarly voice, and then, bingo!
The door opens.